afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Melody Cederstrom, and you're listening to Financial Survival. The second and third segment today, yes, I'm pleased to have my conversation with James Corbett of the Corbett Report. And we did previously record that Wednesday evening, and I'll tell you what, we might have to change this in the future because so much changes from Wednesday to Friday anymore. It's just, but he really does have some very interesting things to talk about, as I had mentioned in yesterday's program. Today is Friday, March 22nd, 2019. So let's go ahead and get to the market reports today. We have gold hanging in there. We have a strong dollar today, and we still were able to see a 380 to the upside with gold at $1,313.80. Silver still struggling at that 1550 level. It was actually down 6 cents today at 1549. Platinum was down $15 at 850, and palladium was down a little over 3%, down 49 bucks at 1559. And of course, if you're talking about industry, you know, and we're all talking about a recession globally, you know, that's going to put a little bit of a damper on demand for these metals. And we'll have to see what's going on there. And there were some interesting reports. I don't know how it would affect some neighboring countries of North Korea, but we'll talk about that here in just a little bit. We have the USDX today is up 0.31 at 96.60. Crude oil was down 105 at 58.93. The stock markets today, closing in, they tried to bring it back. You know, we saw right before the program started, we were down about 380, 390, something like that. And the Dow fell 1.77% today, 25,503 down 459 points. 460 points. It's just a couple of ticks just went through. And the NASDAQ down 196 points, down 2.5% at 7,642. And the S&P 2,800, down 54 points. That's just a little shy of 2% to the downside. 10-year yield. People are piling into that. We're going to talk about that in just a little bit. 0.08 at 2.46%. Let's see if there is anything interesting. You know, I think all focus has pretty much been on the yields, on the 10-year yields. Let me go ahead. And I'm just going to say one thing, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to share this 20 minutes. It was really hectic today here at Discount Gold and Silver Trading, and maybe I shouldn't admit this on the air, but it was really hard to get any type of articles together and read them, think about them, analyze them, and so forth for today for my 20 minutes of Friday's fame, so to speak. So I just pulled some articles and I thought, you know, that I thought were interesting, and we're just going to learn about them together. I'm going to report on them as we go through this. And so it has been, we saw the stumble in Wall Street. We'll talk a little bit about this today. There was a weaker than expected market MPI reading of the U.S. factory activity in March, along with some bad reports from Europe and Japan. It helped send the U.S. Treasury yields into an inversion. You have heard us talk about this for how long now? Over a year, with the spread between yields of the three-month Treasury bills exceeding those of the 10-year notes. And yes, the first time since 2007. So we're going to do a time machine, and we're going to go back and remember what happened after 2007. And again, just another signal, just another indication of the risk that is brewing for your hard-earned money. But we've known this. We've known since we've had a fiat dollar. We know this is where we're heading. All the bubbles that have been created over the years just to keep all the systems to create this global network that we have. It was, whether it was, you choose to decide whether it was all by design or whether it was just capitalism, whether it was just all of the above, a combination of more and more, greater greed and greed, more power and wealth. The bottom line is you're the one that's going to be affected. You're the one that is risking your hard-earned money by not paying any attention to these signs. These are warning signs. And how many of these warning signs do you need to have before you begin to act? And I know a lot of you that went back in when the market was a lot lower said, well, the government will always bring it back. Well, there is a day that they will not bring it back. The standard of living is going to change. Your purchasing power is going to change. Stock markets are going to change. It's not going to come back and roar back. Inflation, yes, can have an impact on the numbers. But what do you have? You have worthless paper. And so you have to pay attention to these warning signs. Earlier in the week, we know that the U.S. Federal Reserve concluded their two-day monetary policy meeting with a statement that forecasts no additional interest rate hikes in 2019 because of economic softness. They're coming out and telling you. Highly unlikely they can't do it anymore. They're between a rock and a hard place. If economies were so great, markets would naturally move these rates higher and higher because people were doing better. They could pay the higher rates and so forth and whatnot, but they can't. Everyone in this country, not you guys, most of you, I guarantee you, listening to this program, yeah, you guys are probably in the best shape of the people in this country, except for those of you who still have the majority of your money in paper. You guys know what's coming, but we get so distracted on other things, like the wall, when everything else is going on that's right in front of you, that's far more worse than not having that wall built. Those are distractions. So again, ladies and gentlemen, it's, the treasury yields is the spread between the 3-month treasury bill yield and the 10-year note yield narrowed to a fresh 12-year low this morning, less than a basis point above parity. We have, as I mentioned, the German manufacturing data added to fears about the slowdown in global growth, the Federal Reserve's decision to cease tightening monetary policy. Signs, everywhere there's signs. The 10-year yield broke below the psychologically significant 2.5% level and was last at a 2.471%, its lowest since January of 2018. And so again, we'll continue to talk about this with Dave come Monday. And here, I thought this was interesting. A couple of things that was interesting. The headlines: the federal budget posted a record monthly deficit in February. The U.S. posted its largest monthly budget deficit with a gap of $234 billion, breaking the previous $231.7 billion mark that was set in February of 2012. Can you remember all the stimulus that was being pushed into these markets in 2012? And we hit a record in February? The only reason we're hitting a February, yes, you can say, is because of the tax cuts, the big picture. The deficit for the first 5 months of this fiscal year jumped to $542 billion. This is a 40% increase from the 2018 fiscal year, as you have the corporate and individual tax revenues decline. You don't have tax cuts in a great economy. You save that. Again, it's just another sign. The U.S. budget deficit grew by $113 billion in fiscal year 2018. I don't know why, if folks can't see this, I would like to know. Please call me and tell me why you think these are not big issues. Today, President Trump says he's withdrawing just announced North Korea sanctions. President Trump raised eyebrows on today with a tweet declaring he would be withdrawing additional large-scale sanctions on North Korea. They were just announced yesterday by the Treasury Department. The Treasury did announce sanctions yesterday on two shipping companies it said had attempted to evade North Korea, to evade North Korea's sanctions. But get this. White House Press Secretary Sarah Sanders, and I like her. I really like Sarah. Told reporters the decision was made because President Trump likes Chairman Kim. And he doesn't think these sanctions will be necessary. It's hard to believe that the Treasury would make these sanctions without the approval of President Trump to begin with. Although we're talking about little Mnuchin, maybe he would have. But it's hard to believe that any of those that surround President Trump, like Mnuchin and Pompeo and, you know, his really close advisors, would do something, put sanctions on a shipping company without him knowing. And the reason you take it off is because you like the guy? Are you kidding me? That does not give me confidence, ladies and gentlemen. Something else. Earlier today, I was reading David Stockman. You heard us talk about David Stockman before. And he had this thing where he was writing to promote his book. And that's okay. But I thought what he wrote about pushing his book, and it was kind of like where I was at during the election of 2016. And he writes in November, I always had doubts, but you hope. On November 8th, 2016, Donald Stockman casted his vote for Donald Trump for President of the United States. He wanted the Great Disruptor. He wanted the swamp drained, as I. And above all, he wanted America to truly become great again. That's what we all wanted. That's what we all want. But it didn't happen. He says none of it. Instead, we're in a far worse, far more dangerous spot than we were over 2 years ago. One where the welfare state and the warfare state threaten to destroy our economy. Our national debt is approaching an astounding $23 trillion. One where border wars, trade wars, and Twitter wars have stolen our focus from a ticking time bomb in the stock market. And one where the deep state has boldly emerged from out of the shadows to steal our democracy right from under us. This is David Stockman. He wanted President Trump to weed out the lifetime politicians who were long ago bought and paid for by special interests and corporations. He wanted President Trump to get us out of the pointless, expensive wars and conflicts abroad. He wanted to instill some financial sanity by letting the stock market begin its natural reset and by cutting our massive national debt. But thanks to the actions of the deep state and to Trump's own spectacular mistakes, the situation has become far worse for your money, your freedom, and your future. And I just thought that was like, yes, I voted for President Trump and I wanted America to be great again. The other half of me was saying it's not going to happen because it can't happen. Because all of the problems that we have are not being addressed. We were taken on personally what I believe in, and I still, I hope. But then yesterday, and I know many of you listening to this program, you've told me, I get tired of hearing you bash President Trump. I'm not bashing President Trump. I'm here to try to help you see perhaps a different way, that maybe what you're seeing is not what is the reality of things. And I couldn't believe I saw this. And this was from Mike Pompeo. He was being interviewed on, I don't know if I can bring this up my computer, but he was, Pompeo agrees it's possible God raised Trump to protect Israel from Iranian aggression. I don't know, ladies and gentlemen. To me, it's, and we'll talk about this maybe on Tuesday with Butch, and let him decide, let him guide us in that direction. I saw President Trump interviewed with Maria Bartiromo, and she asked him about Bibi Netanyahu's upcoming election. Trump says, "Oh, I don't know anything about that." Come on, ladies and gentlemen. Really? He knows everything. His decision about the Golan Heights has everything to do about Bibi's election. It has everything to do with Jared Kushner. It has everything to do with his daughter. And I'm not an expert in that area. I'm in finances. But what I'm trying to say is, I can't believe we're having these it just creeps me out. It doesn't creep me out, it's amazement. Mike Pompeo. And I'm not judging anybody's faith, belief, or anything. It's just, I don't know. So what I do know is, I know that folks need to get prepared. And we're going to see this break apart, I believe. They might be able to hold together till 2020. But a lot's happening this year, so you need to get protected. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. And if you want to share with me your thoughts, send me an email. discountgoldandsilver@yahoo.com. discountgoldandsilver@yahoo.com. We still got some great prices, great specials on the 90% silver and quarter ounce American Gold Eagle. So give us a call. And I hear the music. We're heading into a break, and I will be returning with James Corbett. Please stay tuned, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back.
Since the beginning of the United States, kings have sought it, nations have fought for it. It has been traded, borrowed, purchased, and stolen. There is a reason for it. To secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, invest with the security of gold and silver. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Listen to Financial Survival with your host, Melody Cederstrom, on Shortwave Radio. Visit discountgoldandsilvertrading.net or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. For the very best in gold and silver trading, call toll-free 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Call now.
Melody Cederstrom and CSE Talk Radio team up as Common Sense Voices of Integrity. I personally endorse Melody Cederstrom to be your trusted go-to expert for all your precious metal needs. Experts agree a financial crisis and even collapse is inevitable. Given our government's lack of economic leadership and self-interests of those in power, it's no longer a question of if you should purchase gold and silver, but if you will purchase gold and silver before it's too late. Melody encourages you to tune in each weekday morning. Visit CSETalkRadio.com. We both agree truth and education are the two significant factors in both our missions. There is a wealth of misinformation out there. Let Melody and Beth Ann help you sort through the chaos and bring you home to the truths that will ensure that you and your family are protected. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading 1-800-375-4188 or online at DGScoins.com. Melody and Beth Ann are strong forces together working to preserve liberty and bring America home.
Financial Survival, and I'm Melody Cederstrom, and yes, I am pleased to welcome back to the program James Corbett. And of course, we know that James Corbett is the founder and editor of the Corbett Report, and he found that in 2007. He then became the editorial writer for the International Forecaster, and of course, we know that was created by the economic analyst Bob Chapman. And that was in 2012. And please, please, please visit his website at thecorbettreport.com. And, of course, you can also request a complimentary copy of the International Forecaster just by going to their website, theinternationalforecaster.com. Well, good. Well, I should say hello, James.
Yeah, don't guess morning, afternoon, or evening. I think we're in different time zones. But, yes, good day to you.
Good day. And, you know, I've been trying to start the program in a different way past couple of times, and I'm going to go back to my old way. How would you like to start the program? Is there anything in particular you would like to share with
Well, luckily I'm ready for this question, I have a rant prepared.
Okay.
Let's give your listeners a little sneak preview of this weekend's editorial for the International Forecaster.
Terrific.
I was listening today to the podcast of Ernie Hancock, who does a radio program called Declare Your Independence, and he had a guest, Paul Rosenberg, who is a crypto anarchist, and he wrote The Lodging for Wayfaring Men and other things that some of your listeners might be familiar with. If not, they can acquaint themselves with Paul Rosenberg. I don't want to give the wrong address. I believe his site is Freeman'sPerspective.com, Freeman'sPerspective.com, and they were talking about the wake of this Christchurch shooting that obviously took place last week, and specifically about the response, the New Zealand government response, and the telecom response to the people who were either posting the video or talking about the incident or posting the manifesto that this shooter allegedly left and all of this. And they were talking about the sort of online crackdown of this. And it very quickly, that conversation got down to the fundamental root of what this is really about, in a way that I haven't heard articulated very often. So I'm going to be writing about it in some more detail this weekend. But fundamentally, what Paul Rosenberg was pointing out is we are on the cusp. If you are giving these big tech giants your data, we are going to, as human beings, we are going to lose free will. That's kind of a bizarre statement if you're not understanding how to interpret that. What does that have to do with free will? What does censorship online have to do with free will? What does big tech and big data have to do with it? But he was making the point. Your listeners might have seen last year there was a leaked internal Google video that Google itself had produced internally, and it was for employees to talk and discuss. And it was called The Selfish Ledger. It was leaked online, and now you can go watch it. It's up on YouTube, so you can go see it. But essentially, this is talking about how the data about our existence, who we talk to, where we go, what we do when we get there, what we're interested in, what we're Googling and asking about, is, in an important sense, who we are as human beings. And the more data that is collected about those things, the more cookie crumbs that are on that trail, the more that big tech giants like Google can actually tell about us and ultimately predict about us. And this Selfish Ledger video takes it even one step further, because with that data and knowing who we are and what sort of what buttons to push, where we're likely to go, who we're likely to talk to, the kinds of activities we like to engage in, we can be nudged. We can actually be directed in one direction or another simply by what information is put in front of us, or what something like Google or one of these big tech giants, what they suggest for you here and there. And ultimately, the more we get bogged into these smartphones and all these other devices that are constantly telling us, well, basically everything. Where are we going to go? How do we get there? You know, who are we going to meet there? Eventually, our entire lives will be directed by these big tech giants. And this is not some far-off dystopian fantasy. As Paul Rosenberg was pointing out, we are already there to a large extent. People's lives are now being directed one way or another by these devices and these platforms that we're using. And that's such an important point, and not enough people are talking about this. So I really want to highlight this and underscore it about 10 times with 7 exclamation marks after it.
But you know what's frightening about that is when you look to the youth, the millennials, how do you change their, I mean, us as adults in the ages that we are, we see this and we're horrified by it. I mean, this is nothing more than legal mind control. They're controlling the thoughts in order to make you do things and to guide you and place you into a position where they want you to. And we, you know, they talk a lot about robots. Well, the people eventually become robots to some degree. I mean, they're totally controlled.
Yeah. And you bring up the good point, is that to a certain extent, perhaps there are those of us who are old enough that this will not ultimately be, you know, the defining point of our life, because we at least remember the time before these devices and these services were online, before there was an online. But yeah, there's an entire generation growing up now that's never known anything different. And think of the generation after them that will be even further embedded in this, the digital natives, as they're called. That is really the scary part. I'm not so worried about myself, although I think we all experienced this to some extent, but my children, who are going to be growing up in this, and it's the Matrix. I mean, it is a Matrix. That movie does provide a very powerful allegory for the time that we're living in, and it's not even so analogous anymore so much as it's becoming reality. People are steeping themselves, in some cases quite literally, into a virtual reality that's being created around them. At any rate, we're getting the concept of augmented reality, where people are going to be walking around with their Google glasses or whatever the next trendy, you know, fashion tech trend is going to be, that will be telling them about the world that they are experiencing and eventually telling them what to think and how to interact in that world. And that's the point at which we stop being human beings and start being automatons, essentially, that are being programmed from the outside.
The other frightening thing about that is I don't see how it's going to change. I mean, that is the direction. And I mean, if we wanted to, you know, predict the future, I mean, we're here talking about this interaction, the control, it's not going to change. I mean, this is going to progress. You can't reverse it.
No,
it's
not
going to be reversed.
Yes, this is not a trend that you can reverse, because it is going in that direction. And the only thing that will stop that in any way is to simply not give the data. And that's becoming even more difficult. I mean, to a certain extent, you can ditch your smartphone, you can go offline. I mean, assuming you can even do that, because now, of course, more and more people's jobs literally depend on them being connected in some way. But assuming you have the luxury to be able to go offline, it's still, at this point, it's becoming more and more difficult to actually escape it. As we've found out through the genetic testing, you don't need to have the DNA of every single person in the population in order to map out the entire population's genetic code. You just need enough people. If you have enough people that are related to you, then you essentially know your genetic code. If you have enough people who are online and Facebooking and Instagramming and whatever and sending their data off to big tech, then you're going to be in that matrix one way or another. You just might be the kind of shadow entity. And that's something that I've heard from a lot of people when they have gone to sign up for something like Facebook. They've resisted for many years, but they need to for their new job or whatever it is. So they go to sign up, and suddenly Facebook, that has never had a profile on them ever, is suggesting friends to them that they know in real life, but there's no possible way Facebook could know this. How could they know this? How do they know who my friends in real life are? I don't even have their phone number in my phone or anything like that. I have no relation to them, but Facebook knows. This is the kind of thing that we're stumbling into, and people are always surprised when this happens. But I think it's because, no, there is this gigantic, not just the Google selfish ledger about each individual, but it's really a ledger on the entire population that's being constructed right now. And most people don't even know it exists, let alone why that's a problem.
And most don't even care. You know, it's just, they're caught up in it. And regardless of the age, the young ones and so forth, it's they don't want to know. There's so many distractions out there. And you know, as far as I'm concerned, it's all kind of all by design. You know, getting the people, setting the people up to their, so that they're just readily able to accept it. And that's all kind of conditioning of the people to some degree. And, you know, I don't know how long this technology has been around, how new it is and so forth. But,
Well, I think one of the ramifications of this is that there's going to be a splitting off of the population. The vast majority of people are going to be in the first group, and that will be the group that goes along to gets along. I mean, yeah, of course I use Google, I use Facebook, whatever, you know, what's the big deal? Or maybe even they think, well, I don't really like it, but, you know, what else can you do? There's nothing else out there. And there will be a very small sliver of the population that is actually invested in getting around these systems, not feeding their data, very specifically not feeding their data to these big tech giants, and who embrace alternative technologies and alternative ways of interacting and spreading information online, and know about things like VPNs and IPFS and all these other acronyms that probably mean nothing to most people. That very small sliver of the population, I think there is the chance for that sliver to be able to live in something approaching freedom, perhaps. But that's the only, I think, possibility of freedom that's coming here, and it will be a small proportion of the population.
Does this kind of go into, or can you combine what you're talking about now with the recent article you wrote about this is what a demographic crunch looks like to some degree?
Yeah, and actually in a weird way. So this is an article that I wrote last week for the International Forecaster that's about the population crisis, the crunch that's coming here in Japan. As people probably know by now, the population of Japan is shrinking. It is now a shrinking country. More people are dying than being born. It's an aging population. All of the things that come along with this idea of a demographic crunch. We've been hearing our entire lives about the overpopulation crisis. Well, here is the thin edge of the wedge of what is really coming demographically, which is an underpopulation crisis. And Japan has a front row seat to this crisis, as with a lot of other crises, actually. So I'm writing about this and some of the surprising ways that's manifesting in Japan that I experience here every day. One of which that I point out is that suddenly I often go to cafes to write late at night, to write the newsletter, and it's just easier for me to not be at home and distracted by all the buzzing and things, you know. So I just go to a cafe, I get a coffee, I write on my laptop. And most of the cafes around here, there's quite a few of them that are open late, open till midnight. And so I go there and I type. I noticed, hey, suddenly this cafe that used to be open till midnight is now closing at 10 p.m. and this one is closing at 11 and this one's closing at 9 and this one, what's going on? All of a sudden, all of these different cafes are all closing earlier than usual. And I didn't really put it together. I didn't realize this was a coordinated thing until later on. I'm reading just a news story here about 7-Eleven is now going to be testing opening from 7 to 11, like their name says, instead of 24 hours, which is the operating mandate for 7-Eleven franchisees in Japan. Well, all the franchisees are saying, hey, wait, you know, we can't do this anymore. We need to close earlier. Why? because there aren't enough workers in the Japanese population anymore. There's a huge labor crunch that's happening here as part of this demographic crisis. There's just not enough new blood coming into the economy, not enough new workers. And so there is a big labor shortage here, not just in retail, although that is happening. So obviously cafes and convenience stores and what have you are now closing earlier because they literally can't staff their stores. But also it's happening in construction. It's happening all over the economy. And so that was sort of the hitting home moment. I mean, we read about things like demographic crunch and shrinking population and aging population and things like this, but that was one of those ones where it kind of hit me in the face. Oh, this thing that is happening that is influencing my life is because of this abstract demographic phenomenon that I read about. But the more interesting or the more crazy or scary, I don't know how to frame it, version of this is another story that I saw recently about a temple in Kyoto, here in Japan, which a Buddhist temple that is now, there is now a robotic priest that is preaching to the monks. And you have to see the video of this to understand how bizarre and creepy and weird it is to see all these Buddhist monks bowing towards this robot priest deity. It's so strange. But this again is to some degree a reflection of the demographic crunch that's coming. And of course the Japanese population is being softened up for the, well, we can't have, you know, care workers for everyone. There just aren't enough people to go around, but we can have care robots for everyone. And we're starting to see the robotization of the Japanese economy and everyone getting prepped for more and more robots, robot vending machines in convenience stores or robot baristas at the cafe. They're already kind of rolling it out in a PR kind of way right now, but it's coming in a very real way very soon. And this, of course, relates right back to what we're talking about, the growing technological grid that is going in around us that fewer people are going to be able to escape one way or another. You're going to have a robot barista serving you your coffee. And, of course, again, all of that data about what you're doing and where you're going is, of course, going to be scanned and databased by the facial recognition software and all the other things that are going to be part of this web that's being constructed right now that will all run on the 5G microwave radiation background that's, of course, is going to fry everyone while they're surveilling you.
What is Japan? Is Japan open to immigration to fill those?
Not very widely. The door is not open.
No, I didn't think so. But will those doors open?
That's a huge and growing political issue here. And in fact, just last year, the Abe government put forward some changes to that, opens the door a little bit wider for some migrant workers to come in, some unskilled workers to come in. But obviously, it's a huge political issue here, and there's a lot of backlash. So, yes, technically, it might be theoretically possible for a immigrant worker to get into the country, but not very easily, although that is changing.
And what's the healthcare? What type of healthcare, and how is the healthcare in Japan? I mean,
yes, healthcare is universal. It's everybody has to pay into it, and everybody has healthcare here. I can attest that you basically never pay. You go to the hospital, you pay maybe a token fee for the medication you get, but it isn't very much. But everyone does pay into the system, and it is universal.
Okay. Well, we're heading into a break right now, universally. Anyway, we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen. Please stay tuned. You're listening to Financial Survival. And I'm Melody Cederstrom, and I'm here with James Corbett.
Oh, won't you tell me again? Oh, can you feel it? Oh, won't you tell me again tonight? Each and every
food prices have increased over 40%. Energy prices have increased over 20%. Wheat and gas prices have increased over 70%. What's going to be next? Do you see these trends reversing or even stabilizing? All fiat currencies have always failed and collapsed their economies on their way down. The Roman Empire, China, France, Argentina, Finland, Mexico, Russia, Zimbabwe all tried fiat currency and all collapsed into chaos. Meanwhile, the dollar has lost over 97% of its gold value since 1971, when an ounce of gold was valued at $35. If your assets are in paper, you are in danger. Protect your assets with gold and silver. Visit Discount Gold and Silver Trading at DGScoins.com. That's DGScoins.com, or call 1-800-375-4188. That's 800-375-4188. Protect yourself and your family.
We all know that Berkey Water Purification Systems are the most trusted name in water filtration. As an authorized Berkey dealer for over 6 years and serving thousands of satisfied customers, the Berkey Guy offers amazing specials for Berkey Water Filtration Systems. The Berkey Light Systems include a set of self-sterilizing and recleanable black purification elements that purify water by removing chlorine, pathogenic bacteria, cysts, and parasites to non-detectable levels and remove harmful chemicals such as herbicides and pesticides. Order the Berkey Light System today, complete with two black Berkey elements for only $231, and the Berkey Guy will ship your order free of charge. With the purchase of a Berkey Light, the Berkey Guy is also offering a set of fluoride and arsenic filters for only $39.99. That's over 30% off the retail price. Call the Berkey Guy at 1-877-886-3653. That's 1-877-886-3653. Or order online at GoBerkey.com. That's GoBerkey.com today.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. You're listening to Financial Survival, brought to you by Discount Gold and Silver Trading. 1-800-375-4188. That's 1-800-375-4188. Heading into the break, we were talking about the demographic crunch that James wrote about in the recent Corbett Report newsletter. Is there any final comments or conclusions you would like to add to that before we move on to...
Well, I suppose I'll tell you in a few years, but I mean, but really, Japan is going to get a sort of front row seat to the way this is going to play out. And as I pointed out on my podcast before, it is happening in a number of different countries right now. There is absolute population shrinkage beginning, and we're seeing the beginnings of this in a lot of countries. And of course, the replacement rate for overall births in a lot of different countries is now below replacement rate. So Korea and a whole list of other countries, Italy and Greece and many other places, are now falling below replacement levels, and quite substantially so. So again, this is, however Japan decides to deal with this, is going to be a model, either positive or negative, for other countries. But it will be interesting to see the way that this plays out, because of course, as I'm sure your listeners are well aware, our entire economic model and monetary system and everything is based on never-ending increasing debt, increasing global economic activity. And the idea of a shrinking economic pie is just one that is not based on, and is going to lead to a collapse of the system as it is right now. What will be along to replace it? That's, of course, the big question that we always keep coming back to on this program, isn't it?
You know, Chinese leader President Xi Jinping is visiting Europe this week. He's traveling to France, Italy, Monaco. The President for Life's tour come as European powers are seeking to strike a delicate balance between concerns about Chinese influence and, you know, further investment. What do you think President Xi's real agenda with these nations are? And do you see what type of outcomes will likely be seen as from his visit?
I think primarily this is a sort of diplomatic softening up of Europe with regards to the Belt and Road Initiative, the big trade infrastructure project that China is engaged in right now to try to essentially connect Chinese markets to European markets. I mean, that's one of the major things that this is ultimately going to end up doing. And I think China, of course, knows that, especially in the light of its ongoing trade war with the United States, that its bread is buttered on the side of Eurasia more so than North America. So I think this is part of that diplomatic tour that is happening right now to basically quell some of the fears and concerns that people might have over this. And there are mounting concerns, as we've talked about on the program before. When China was just going around handing out money hand over fist, of course, everyone's taking it. It's only later on that they start to wonder, maybe there's some strings attached here. Maybe this isn't a good deal for us. And one example of that is in Malaysia right now, where Mahathir Mohamad, the 93-year-old prime minister, has basically nixed or put on hold a lot of the projects that his previous prime minister had created with China. On the back of a lot of allegations that Malaysian prime minister was receiving kickbacks from China in order to give sweetheart deals to Chinese construction companies and what have you. Long story short, some pretty major projects, including a major high-speed train link that was being slated to be constructed in Malaysia, has been put on hold. It was slated to be a $13 billion project. The latest estimates are if they went ahead with it, it would probably be $32 billion, a significant amount of money for Malaysia. And so they're putting the brakes on this and saying, whoa, I think this isn't for our benefit. Clearly, this is for the Chinese construction company's benefit and maybe for Chinese diplomatic benefit, but what are we really getting out of this? Is this in our own best interest? And I think a lot of countries now are starting to step back and recalculate whether or not all of this seeming manna from heaven that's coming from Beijing is really that great, or are there strings attached here? And so it's in the wake of this, and of course, right before a conference on the Belt and Road Initiative that I believe is happening next month, that Xi Jinping is on this diplomatic tour to try to ease everyone's nerves and just say, no, you know, we're here to be trade partners with the world and everything's going to be great and fine and dandy, and, you know, just make sure that you're on the right side of history because we're going to be the future. So I think that's going to be a primary focus of
Malaysia wouldn't have any, I mean, it's not like they can say, okay, we're done with you.
I mean, clearly that's...
there's no one there to replace China.
Yeah. No, I mean, clearly a lot of the countries that are recipients of this Chinese aid, it's not exactly aid, but whatever you call it, are one way or another dependent on China. So they can't exactly just stick a middle finger in their face and walk away. I mean, they're obviously going to be trading partners with China. It's just a question of, you know, is this a raw deal? And if so, how much of a raw deal? And should we be standing up for it? And it's just interesting that even a relatively close partner like Malaysia would be now standing up and potentially saying no to China.
Was Malaysia in the TPP?
I believe so. I'd have to double check that, but I believe they were one of the countries. Yeah.
Would they be? Would this conversation be if the TP was rewritten or
Yeah, that's a hypothetical negative that is hard to answer, that's just a reflection, I think, of the overall jumble of competing interests that are happening right now. And I think there's a growing awareness that Southeast Asia is demographically one of the few places in the planet that has a growing young population, and thus is seen economically as a driver for growth, a global growth in the future. And I think a lot of people are trying to get in ahead of that. Of course, one of the interests is the U.S. clearly has an interest in being there economically, business-wise, to scoop up those new markets. And China, of course, is equally interested. So I think we're seeing a bit of that proxy confrontation, and that's reflected in things like the Belt and Road Initiative and the TPP and other grand projects for trying to steer these countries one way or another when it comes to, you know, which side are they going to be on.
Let's see. Basel III Accord about the banks able to, I believe, at the end of March, the rule goes into effect that will allow gold to become fully valued and monetized as a tier one asset for banks around the world. McGuire. Is it Andrew McGuire? That's right, Andrew McGuire. He argues that the Basel III Accord is going to effectively re-monetize physical gold, and the price of gold is going to be soaring. What are your thoughts on that, James?
Well, that's interesting. I'd have to read McGuire's take on that, because Certainly, I know about his story, his whistleblowing story. So I think it would be interesting to get his take on it. I haven't read it yet, so I don't know about that. But is it possible? I believe it is, but I haven't done the kind of hard research into Basel III to know whether that's going to be likely. I find it, I mean, just generally speaking, I find it a little bit, there's pause for thought every time I hear about gold is just about to soar, because I've been hearing that for a very long time. And I think the real value of gold is in long-term holding and maintaining value, rather than looking for some sort of, you know, riches that's going to result from an explosion of the market. But I certainly stand to be corrected, and I'm very interested to see McGuire's take on that.
I do remember we talked about, I can't remember if I talked about this with Bob, because it's this the tier one with gold, the Basel Accord III was back in 2012, and I remember talking about it long ago, and then it was just forgotten, and they pushed this date up until, you know, the end of March of this year, which is kind of interesting, the timing of it and all. And of course, I'm not sure if Andrew McGuire is the first one who brought it up, but it's being discussed. And so, it is really interesting. And, you know, what will the case? I don't know if we're going to have any type of knee-jerk reaction as far as, you know, going up, gold going up April 1st, or if it's going to be a long-term, or what type of impact it will actually truly have. So
Here's one of the factors that's interesting in that, is that clearly there are countries that have, if not disinvested in gold, at least have not been particularly voracious in their appetite for gold. The U.S., England, and others have not really been, I mean, to whatever extent we can trust the official numbers of official holdings, that's a whole other story. But even if we were to take those numbers at face value, they have not been seeking to expand, and in some cases have even been shrinking their gold reserves. Whereas we know that we don't know how much gold China has, for example. We know that we can't trust their numbers, but we do know that after a very long time of them reporting the exact same amount of gold reserves, a couple of years ago, they started admitting that, oh, we have a little bit more this month, and we have a little bit more this month. So they did start aligning their numbers something more with reality. It still, I think, remains to be seen how much gold reserve they have. But certainly countries like China, like Russia, obviously like India, have been voraciously consuming gold for a number of years now and have been increasing their reserves. So, I mean, if we were to see a fundamental change, I mean, obviously this revolves around commercial banking and their charters and what counts as different tiers of capital. But if that has an effect on gold prices to a significant degree, and if gold does return in whatever form, if not necessarily as a dollar for ounce backing or something of a currency, at least as something that is reflected in gold reserves equals a stable currency or something like that, then it's very possible that countries like China and Russia and some of the other BRICS members might come out ahead in this, diplomatically speaking. Mm-hmm. Which, from my mind, I mean, again, this is speculation after speculation, so this isn't a well-thought-out thesis that I'm standing behind, but to my mind, it is interesting that we are, I think, being shepherded into the new multipolar world, where we're going to be asked to believe that the BRICS are virtuous, and if not completely spotless, at least better than the alternatives, so we better turn to them. And if that is the case, I mean, we know that they've been arguing for the de-linking of the world monetary supply from the U.S. dollar as a global reserve for a number of years, and China has obviously been angling to at least obviously be included in the SDR basket, the IMF special drawing rights basket, and to be taken more seriously as a global player on the currency stage. So this could theoretically, I mean, again, depending how this plays out, could be another step in that direction towards, I certainly don't think the Chinese yuan is going to suddenly become the world reserve currency, but it could be a more important player than it is, relatively speaking, to the dollar right now.
You wrote in your most recent article in the Corbett Report, and listeners can go to the report, thecorbettreport.com, and follow it and read it. False flags over Kashmir. And we've seen these growing tensions between these nuclear neighbors, India and Pakistan. We certainly had the suicide bombing in Kashmir last month, and Pakistan struck back. You equate this recent incident to violence in the Balkans over a century ago and ask, what does this have to do with us? You add that we ignore the events there at our own peril. Can you tell us a little more about this?
Yes. Well, the parallel there, I think, I hope is obvious to the audience, as I've been talking about on my podcast recently about World War One, and it's certainly possible, and I think a lot of people in 1914 might have heard about the assassination of the Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo and gone, eh, you know, that's terrible, but whatever, and went about their daily business. Probably some people higher up might have really understood the repercussions of that. But even so, I think there were a lot of people who were caught by surprise that that was in particular the mechanism that essentially sprang the trap that was World War One. Obviously, there's a much bigger story as to how World War One really started, but that's kind of the trigger moment. And so I think it is certainly possible that some sort of incident in Kashmir or some place like that that isn't necessarily in the front and center of the headlines every day could be the event that sets off a wider confrontation, especially because Kashmir geographically is a place that brings together the borders of China and India and Pakistan, three countries that have all had some tumultuous history and been at war in one permutation or another in recent memory. That's a powder keg in search of a match, essentially. And India and Pakistan, of course, always at each other's throats. So all sorts of miscalculations can happen in something like this. And compounding the most recent skirmish and tit-for-tat and back and forth is that Indian Prime Minister Modi is up for re-election very soon, and of course it always plays well with the electorate to look like the big tough man who's taking on the terrorists, so that motivates, he's incentivized essentially to respond militarily to any provocation. And we have a sort of unknown factor in the relatively new Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan, so all of this is very worrying in what it portends for the possibility of sparking a much greater confrontation. And of course, again, India and Pakistan are nuclear powers, so that should be something that we all have in mind. But even if it were only, in quotation marks, only India and Pakistan nuclear powers in some sort of nuclear exchange, that would still undoubtedly bring in China, which, as I say, is right there on the border, and of course the US, which is taking an increasing role in being in India's corner in the India-China question, who's going to, you know, dominate Asia in the future. And America has done all sorts of things, even going so far as to rename the Asia-Pacific region the Indo-Pacific region. Basically, that's their way of saying, hey, don't worry, India, we're in your corner. So this becomes a big international incident very soon, and that's, I think, something we have to keep in mind.
I think so. This is not a situation to be taken lightly. And again, just another hot spot in the world that we live in today. Ladies and gentlemen, we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining me. Thank you, James, also. I look forward to our conversations, and we'll talk in a couple of weeks. And ladies and gentlemen, be safe out there, and God bless.
Broadcasting to the U.S. and around the world by way of Clear Digital Audio, 22,500 miles above the planet, this is the Global Star Radio Network.